You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, October 28th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Andrew Highsmith, professor of history at UC Irvine, on his book, Demolition Means Progress, Race, Class, and the Deconstruction of the American Dream in Flint, Michigan. Also on the program, it's debate day, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, yes. It's like Christmas in, well, I guess October. Sort of like Halloween in October. We'll have all of the preview, all of the latest from the green room. Meanwhile, Republicans trying to get their last licks at the IRS now that it's clear there was no IRS scandal. Meanwhile, a budget deal announced could be voted on today in the House. Paul Ryan was against it before he was for it. But it's going to make his life much, much easier. And it seems like the conservatives got rolled in this for the most part. Also on the program today, Republicans suddenly infected with the wah-wahs. Koch brothers, John Kasich, Marco Rubio, George Bush, all complaining. It's not fair. Why is Ben Carson winning? Why is Donald Trump winning? Why am I not winning? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, time to pass the Kleenex. Meanwhile, you won't have Dennis Hastert to kick around anymore, unless, of course, you're in prison, in which case you probably will have the opportunity to kick him around a little bit. He pleads guilty, looking at 6 months of jail time for his attempts to skirt reportage of cash withdrawals from banks, ostensibly to pay off somebody about whom we're not supposed to know anything about, but it does appear that it was a case in which he perhaps molested someone. And the CISPA returns in the form of CISA, passes the Senate and is a virtual lock to pass the House and be signed by Barack Obama, a cybersecurity bill that makes your info very much less than secure. We will also hopefully get to the South by Southwest caves to the Gamergate misogynists, and then may actually uncave, concave. I'm not sure exactly what that's called when they... when they think better of it. But part of it was because places like BuzzFeed and Vox said, well, we're not coming if you're going to cave to these, with all due respect, morons. And I mean that very respectfully. I know. I don't believe in integrity in gaming journalism. Oh, God. Ladies and gentlemen, I may not believe in integrity in gaming journalism. I will say this, though. I have been shaving, and I've said this now multiple times, but it's true. I've been shaving with increased frequency. Part of a function of, when I record Ring of Fire, I like to be clean shaven because the folks down in Florida where we get this thing produced like me to be clean shaven. And then when I go on MSNBC, I get a shave just in case my folks see me and I don't want them to think that I'm not shaving. Before my grandmother passed, she was very concerned about me because I didn't shave very often. But what I hate more than shaving is having to shave and know that I've paid, I don't know, an arm and a leg. $32 for an 8-pack of blades? Harrys.com has changed my perspective on shaving. I don't hate it now. It's just a sort of, I got to do it. Harrys.com has an amazing deal for you. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. If you use the promo code MajorityReport and it's your first purchase, you get $5 off that. So if you've never gotten Harry's before, now is the time to try it. For $10, it's 15 minus 5, you get a razor, moisturizing shaving cream, and 3 razor blades. And the blades, apparently, I've been told, work for women as well. Shave your legs. You shave, I don't know, whatever you shave. I'm not saying you have to, but if you do, you might as well get a good razor. Go to harrys.com now. Harry will give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code MajorityReport with your first purchase. That's harrys.com. Enter coupon code MajorityReport at checkout for $5 off and start shaving better today. How could you? They deliver it right to your door, ladies and gentlemen. For $10, you get a razor and 3 shaving blades and the shaving cream. For $10, if it's the first time, you got to give it a try. All right, folks, as a little preview tonight for the debate, this was reported. I don't know where this piece showed up. Alec Eisenstadt. During a tense 30-minute meeting at the Coors Event Center, as you know, the debate is taking place in Boulder, Colorado, which was described by 3 sources present, several lower polling campaigns lashed out at the RNC. Now, several lower polling campaigns, that could be really any number of those campaigns. Probably like 10, I think, are low. This is written in Politico. They accused the committee of allotting them less than hospitable green room spaces while unfairly giving lavish ones to higher polling candidates such as Donald Trump and Ben Carson. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I will need a music assist. Trump was granted a spacious room complete with plush chairs and a flat screen TV. Marco Rubio got a theater-type room packed with leather seats for him and his team of aides. Carly Fiorina's room had a jacuzzi. Then there was Chris Christie, whose small space was dominated by a toilet. So was Rand Paul's. This is ridiculous, fumed Christie's campaign manager, Ken McKay. We're in a restroom. And I will say this, as far as Chris Christie being a small space dominated by a toilet, you know, you got to look on the bright side. It could be training for where Chris Christie could be spending, 6 to 12 months, maybe 18 months for his federal indictments. We'll wait and see on that. But it's already broken out. The food fight is already broken out with the RNC candidates where, the front runners. Listen, this is the way the free market works, right? You do well. You're lavished with goods and services because you are morally less reprehensible than the losers. And Chris Christie, Rand Paul, you're losers. We'll talk more about previewing the debate tonight. But ladies and gentlemen, as you know, we have new hires in this office. And I was fortunate enough to have the platform of a podcast to make the announcement that we're looking to hire. But if you don't, and you're short-staffed, you know that there's no time to deal with dozens of different job sites. Until now. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, I can post to 100-plus job sites with one single click and be instantly matched to candidates from over 6 million resumes. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter's been used by over 400,000 businesses. You could try it right now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Try ZipRecruiter and get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Try it out for free now, because the best time to practice and figure out how you're going to hire, specifically if you've got a small business, is when you don't need to hire. Because as a small business owner, I can tell you that I'm completely overwhelmed 95% of the time. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Andrew Highsmith, the author of Demolition Means Progress, Race, Class, and the Deconstruction of the American Dream in Flint, Michigan. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Andrew Highsmith. He's an assistant professor of history at UC Irvine, the author of Demolition Means Progress, Race, Class, and the Deconstruction of the American Dream in Flint, Michigan. Welcome to the program, Andrew.
Thank you, but I actually have a correction. You gave the title of my dissertation, but the book has a different subtitle.
Oh, do tell. Sorry about that.
No problem. It's Demolition Means Progress, Flint, Michigan, and the Fate of the American Metropolis, a more ambitious title for the book.
Indeed. I like the title of the thesis as well. I mean, we'll go with both. Because you're,
sure,
Flint is sort of a fascinating city, and in many respects, I think, you know, the I know that you were living in Flint, over the course of it, or as you started, and I want to get to also what the title, where you picked up the title from, but was it your sense that that Flint? Were you telling a story about Flint, or were you telling a story about the American city, really, over the 20th century? And if the latter, at what point did you realize you were telling that story?
Great questions. In terms of you're right. This project started when I was living in Flint. I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan at the time, and my wife was doing her medical rotations in Flint hospitals, and we decided that we wanted to go up there. It was cheap, and she'd be closer to work. And in the course of living up there, I discovered a lot of interesting facets of Flint's history that hadn't yet been documented by historians, and so decided to do this dissertation. It started as a very close study of municipal politics and development in the city. But over time, I came to realize that what was happening in Flint during the 20th century and into the early 21st century was really happening in a lot of other places. Now, of course, there are always differences depending upon the locale. But what I found is that the differences were more differences of degree and not of kind. And so in my telling of Flint's history, Flint is in many ways representative of broader currents happening in metropolitan America. And so Flint, as in other cities, local municipal and business officials were intimately involved in creating and recreating lines of racial segregation. I also found that public policies in many cases, some of them federal, some of them state and local, were deeply implicated in the maintenance of racial and economic inequality. I found that also that public policies in Flint and elsewhere were deeply part of the city's story of deindustrialization. So in my telling of it, Flint is in many ways representative of a set of broader currents happening in metropolitan America. If you'd like, I can say a little bit about the title, or if you want to wait on that.
Well, no, let's start with that. I mean, let's start with that, and then I do want to go into the sort of those broader trends, because it is the and particularly the concept of, you know, the idea of white flight has often been attributed as sort of leaving the cities bereft, but there's actually another dynamic that's going on there that you talk about in your book that I think is also really fascinating in terms of how it actively there was other active things going on in terms of the city. But let's talk about that title, Demolition Means Progress, because it's super creepy. It's super creepy. Tell us where you got the title from.
Yeah, okay. The title, Demolition Means Progress, comes from the sign that GM once put up in front of its abandoned factories in Flint. Now, for your readers who might not be familiar with Flint, for really the bulk of the 20th century, was the international manufacturing headquarters for General Motors. And General Motors, unlike Detroit, General Motors was really the only game in town in terms of the automobile industry. And so really, Flint was a quintessential factory town, company town, with GM playing a really dominant role in shaping its development. But toward the end of the 20th century, in the 70s and 80s in particular, GM began closing up a lot of its plants in the Flint metropolitan area. And when they did, they put up these signs, not just in Flint, but in other cities, Lansing and other places where they were closing down plants. But the sign said, demolition means progress, suggesting that cities like Flint couldn't really move forward to greatness until these old plants had met the wrecking ball. And now, at first blush, I think, as you mentioned, it sounds kind of a little creepy, sounds like a trite corporate slogan. And in many ways, it was. But it also had a much broader significance. In fact, as I try to show in the book, Demolition Means Progress really expresses the operating ethos of the nation's economic and political leadership throughout most of the 20th century. And what I mean by that is that all over the country, Flint included, business and political leaders looked to demolish what they perceived to be old and inefficient structures and institutions and rebuild them to be more profitable. So they demolished poor African-American neighborhoods and replaced them with freeways and public housing. They tore down old urban factories and rebuilt them in the suburbs, and so on. But there were grave consequences, I discovered, to that sort of approach. In their perennial quest to grow the economy, GM executives and Flint's civic and political leaders, just like their counterparts elsewhere in the U.S., ultimately hardened social inequities. They hardened lines of racial segregation, they hardened economic inequalities, and they hardened jurisdictional boundaries between various parts of the metropolis. And so for me, Demolition Means Progress is a metaphor for this constant process of urban renewal that I trace in the book. And those processes of renewal ultimately helped to make Flint one of the most racially segregated, economically polarized, and politically fragmented regions in the U.S. And so for me, Demolition Means Progress, it's a catchy slogan, good for a book cover, but it also does some analytical work as well.
Right. And you know, I have to say, I mean, I don't want to stumble into Godwin's law here, But the idea of that demolition means progress over a manufacturing plant just brings up some very creepy analogies for me. But we'll leave it there. And I should say too that it was the closing of these plants in some ways that I think most Americans are familiar with Flint, Michigan, because it ultimately led to Michael Moore, who I believe had grown up in Flint. Led to his Roger and Me, which was his sort of like, seminal documentary where he was going to find out from the CEO of GM, like, you know, what have you done to Flint, essentially? But tell us the impetus. I mean, I sort of feel like we should probably go back to 1910, where we start with the boom of Flint and the sort of the housing that's provided by GM, to show just sort of how all of these things integrate. And by integrate, I mean, that's maybe perhaps an unfortunate word choice, how these notions of capitalism and the different sort of agendas of different capitalists intersect with racism in back in 1910 in rather overt ways, and then as you go further, the less overt and less, part and parcel, but certainly, you know, part of it. But so let's start with 1910, so we work our way up in terms of the history, so we get a sense of just how sort of intertwined these different themes are.
Okay, yeah. So to move it back to 1910, we're talking about the period right after the founding of General Motors and Flint's emergence on the national scene as, you know, a burgeoning industrial city. And as GM grew and acquired other companies and became, you know, one of the world's leading manufacturers, Flint grew exponentially and brought in migrants from, in particular, from the boot and heel region of the Upper South, the Missouri, Western Tennessee area, Arkansas, but also migrants from really around the country. And as those migrants arrived in Flint, a really grave series of public housing, public health emergencies emerged, as well as really serious housing shortages. And this is where I pick up the story of GM's involvement in maintaining racial segregation in the book. GM was very embarrassed by these shanty towns, basically, that were being erected around their plants because there wasn't enough standard housing for the workers. And so they decided to launch a new division of the company called the Modern Housing Corporation. And they did this to make Flint more appealing to, you know, prospective workers. And so they built three really large neighborhoods inside the city, and they made those homes available on really generous financing terms to workers and managers at the firm. But they attached stipulations to those deeds when they sold those homes. In particular, they restricted these new company-built homes to only white workers. So they attached racially restrictive housing covenants to all these new homes that they were building. And so from the start, really, GM is intimately involved in maintaining racial segregation. But they also, over time, did similar things. And so, for example, one of the things I trace in the book is how GM played a really dominant role, not only in keeping the city segregated through housing, but also in sustaining so-called urban blight in the city's industrial neighborhoods, particularly in the north end of the city, the historical heart of the Black community. And what I mean by that is that GM, in particular GM's Buick facility on the north end, released large amounts of toxic smokes and ashes into the air, and they were largely unregulated until well into the late 20th century, in the 1970s. And when they released these large amounts of smokes and ashes into the air, it damaged property values and caused numerous public health crises for African Americans living in the North End city. Beyond that, so, GM also played. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let me ask you this. So, when they establish essentially what amounts to whites only housing, there's mm-hmm. is there a motive there beyond just, you know, out and out racism? I mean, is there a bottom line motive, and how does it dovetail with this notion of okay, if we have some type of segregated housing situation, it will allow mm-hmm. us essentially a dumping ground. We will have necessarily parts of the city that have weaker political clout, so that we can then put a plant in that part of the city, and that's basically that's the outhouse essentially, and we will ensure that there is not enough political clout in that neighborhood to stop us from doing what we're doing. Or is it sort of like that's just like a twofer? You know, we get to make sure that our white workers don't have to co-mingle, and we also get this added benefit, which doesn't provide any obstacles to us doing what we want to do.
It's a little bit of both, I think. I mean, there's a couple questions embedded there. I think that the first is about the rationale behind. And these weren't just, you know, like, sort of restricted to whites. They were explicitly restricted to whites by legally binding covenants. And so they were intentional and deliberate. But GM was not the executives who came up with that plan were by no means unique in early 20th century American culture. This was essentially a consensus among vast majorities of whites at the time that racial segregation was anathema to high property values, but also that whites and blacks were incapable of living together peacefully in neighborhoods, and so that their idea that integration was a threat to civic order and property values was really the kind of orthodoxy among white Americans at the time. In terms of their relationship with the North End, I don't think that their decision to pollute was driven explicitly by malice toward African Americans, but rather it was a byproduct of the industrial process. And if it had to be, these toxins had to be released into the air and into the water, that best case scenario that those be restricted to neighborhoods with African Americans, immigrants, lower property values.
Partially because they knew they could get away with it, right? I mean, they're not going to start to spew this stuff, and then there's going to be a community board meeting that says, hey, wait a second, we're going to stop you, and we have the political power to do it. They know.
That's right. Eventually, those sorts of organizations emerge. But at the time, and this is one of the things that I think in some ways separates Flint from other large industrial centers, is that it maintained a very large white majority much longer than other cities like Detroit, for example. And as a result, the African-American community was not only tightly segregated spatially, but also relatively disempowered politically. Because the black community remained very small for so long, they often had to ally themselves with either, you know, trade unionists from the UAW, or alternately, civic leaders and executives from General Motors in order to accomplish to reform the city. But you're right, I think, to note that they were a largely disempowered constituency in the city, at least until well into the late 20th century.
So tell us about the move to create community schools and how this sort of, I mean, what was the intent and did it in some ways backfire?
I think that, well, maybe in the end it backfired.
Well, explain to us what it is, because I'm not sure the people are aware of what this plan was.
Yeah, this is, to me, a really important part of the book, because it's where I try to incorporate schools and educational policies into the broader narrative of metropolitan inequality. I think too often the literature on racial and economic inequality in cities tends to revolve around housing, and housing is profoundly important. But what I found is that schools and education policies were equally important to the maintenance of inequality in Flint. And my treatment of that issue revolves around this community education initiative that was launched by the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation in the 1930s. And in a nutshell, this is kind of a long story, so I'll try to condense it a little bit. But as they looked around them in the 1930s, executives like Charles Stewart Mott, who was a local resident, were deeply troubled by the events that were surrounding them. They were troubled by the early organizational efforts of the UAW. They were troubled by the increasing diversity of the city. They were troubled by the city's rapid population growth. They were accustomed to a very small hamlet that was Flint before the founding of General Motors, a relatively homogenous, extremely segregated city. So they were uncomfortable with the processes of urbanization and industrialization that were surrounding them. And so Mott and his supporters in the city wanted to restore a sense of community by working through the school system. And so what they did was they opened up all of the, well, they started with just a few, but eventually they opened up all of the city's public schools and turned them into essentially around-the-clock community centers. And so they were open after school and on weekends for kids and adults and families. And they had a number of different courses. They had vocational courses. They had courses in traditional, you know, arts and sciences. They had public speaking courses. They also offered a variety of health services. And so they were really, in a lot of ways, a vital part of local communities. But at the same time, they were also predicated on the idea that community solidarity was dependent upon strict racial segregation. And so they operated these community schools as segregated facilities. And as the city's racial geography shifted, they shifted those school attendance boundaries to keep those schools and their community programs starkly segregated. And the idea, again, was that racial segregation was a prerequisite to meaningful forms of community solidarity. And so the Mott Foundation worked with the Board of Education to gerrymander those elementary school districts in which the community schools programs operated. And because the elementary school boundaries in turn shaped the community schools boundaries, those programs remained starkly segregated until well into the 1970s, when the federal government ordered the Flint schools to desegregate. And one of the things I discovered in the process of writing the book is that almost immediately after the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare ordered the schools to desegregate in 1975, the community schools program collapsed. The Mott Foundation withdrew funding for it, and the community schools were ended. I didn't uncover any specific evidence that they canceled that funding because of desegregation, but I also know and discovered in the course of research that men like Charles Stewart Mott were deeply committed to the color line. Mott, for one, during the 1950s, wrote warm letters of support to segregationist senators such as James Eastman from Mississippi and other massive resistors. And so he was profoundly disturbed by the implications of Brown versus Board of Education and committed to maintaining racial homogeneity in the city's school system.
Let's talk about, and this is also a topic that I find really fascinating, because we've had a couple of interviews over the past couple of months about the racial dynamic of the New Deal, that many of these programs were only being able to be instituted if there was a certain amount of racism built into them, so as to sort of trade off of concerns from particularly Southern Democrats. And the Federal Housing Authority, or I guess at that time, There was all sorts of programs that were instituted to help housing, developed a lot of red lines at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And they did so, I would argue, not purely as a concession to white Southern Democrats, but also to Northern racists as well. We're well represented in places like Flint. One of the things, and this is something that scholars, urban historians in particular, have done a marvelous job of documenting, is the ways in which federal housing and development programs launched during the 30s helped to radically resegregate metropolitan centers well into the post-war era. And in a sense, their legacies are still with us in many ways today. And just to for your listeners who might not be familiar, essentially during the 1930s, as a way to resurrect the failing housing markets nationwide, the federal government first launched a program overseen by the Homeowners Loan Corporation to bail out homeowners who were being foreclosed upon. And in the course of conducting property appraisals to determine, you know, which loans to bail out, the Homeowners Loan Corporation created 238 what they called residential security maps of cities and metropolitan regions nationwide. And as part of those maps, they made determinations about which parts of metropolitan areas were safe for investment. Now, the irony is that the Homeowners Loan Corporation actually invested in African-American neighborhoods, but at the same time, their residential security maps argued that black neighborhoods and integrated neighborhoods were really unsafe places for investment. And soon after that, the Federal Housing Administration began its own housing subsidy programs, and they abided by the same principles as the Homeowners Loan Corporation, except they refused to grant mortgage subsidies in African-American and integrated neighborhoods. And so if you wanted to get an FHA-backed loan, really from the 1930s through well into the 1960s, it pretty much had to be in a segregated white residential community. And so these policies, first enacted by the federal government during the 1930s, ended up having lasting effects on our metropolitan landscapes. They helped to create and fortify lines of segregation in Flint and all across the nation. So you're right to say that that's a really important part of the story.
And we should add, too, that it's not just a question of segregation. You're talking about wealth accumulation, you know, which during that period
Absolutely.
Of time, you know, housing becomes the primary vehicle for retirement savings and for passing on wealth to your kids. And it would also impact the nature of those communities insofar as you have a lot more higher incidence of essentially, you know, slumlords or absentee landlords and rental units, because you don't have the same rights of home ownership that you do in white areas, because they don't have simply the same opportunity to credit. And so then you have a different relationship between, you know, some type of critical mass of the people who live there and their homes and their neighborhood.
Yes, absolutely. It sounds like you may have interviewed my friend and colleague, Nathan Connolly, who wrote a fantastic book called A World More Concrete about race and metropolitan development in South Florida. And that was exactly one of his findings.
We haven't, but he's on our list now.
Yeah, put him on your list. He'd be a great person to talk to. And he actually explores in great detail the connection between federal home ownership policies and the growth of slumlords and slum districts in South Florida. I would recommend talking to him.
We've got him on the list now. So let's go to a little bit. So post-war, we have, you know, what we, I guess, refer to sometimes as white flight from the cities. And you mm-hmm. get... sort of a split between what you call the metropolitan and suburban capitalists. And also this dynamic of, it's not simply a question of people leaving the city. It is that they are specifically following policies in their new, I guess, communities that diminish prospects for the city.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot in your question there. Let me try to unpack some of that. I think that I mean, the start point for this story is what we were just talking about the ways in which the policies of the Federal Housing Administration helped to shift investment ultimately from cities to suburbs, to segregated suburbs. But at the same time, there was another set of migrations happening in Flint and elsewhere, and these were migrations of capital and industry from the city to the suburbs. And what happened in Flint is that between 1940 and 1960, General Motors built 8 new industrial complexes around the city of Flint, but all of them in the suburbs, not in the city. And so they radically shifted their investment patterns into this metropolitan sphere. One of the things that I was really surprised by in the course of writing this book, I started thinking that when GM moved its plants from the city to the suburbs, that effectively marked the onset of the city's industrial crisis. It marked the corporate sort of analog of white flight, leading the city, turning its back on it. But what I actually found is that when GM moved its plants during the post-war period from city to suburbs, they actually wanted the city to absorb those plants either through annexation or metropolitan government. And to describe this strategy of corporate development, I use the term metropolitan capitalism, meaning that GM wanted to shift its resources from the city to suburbs. They saw the suburbs as the ideal place for new factories and investment, but at the same time, they also wanted to grow the city. So they were not, at least at that point in time, interested in abandoning the city of Flint. Rather, they wanted to expand its boundaries.
Was the value for them to do that?
An economy of scale. They saw metropolitan governments as being far more efficient than fragmented jurisdictional boundaries. And so, for example, they thought that if there was
let me just ask you this too, as you go, when you say economies of scale, you're not talking that they wanted necessarily. This was based on a civic mindedness, or was it, as opposed to like, we can deal with them much easier if there's just one guy.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And that the process of delivering government services and utilities and things like that would be much more efficient and cost effective if there was a metropolitan government. And they really put their money where their mouth was, so to speak. They supported in the late 1950s a metropolitan government plan called New Flint, which would have expanded Flint's boundaries to include a lot of the urbanized suburbs just outside of the city. Ultimately, that plan was foiled in part by white suburbanites who revolted at the prospect of affiliating with the city. And so in contrast to what I call the metropolitan capitalist vision of General Motors, we had what I refer to as suburban capitalism. That is a different sort of view about how to best develop suburbia. And these were largely driven by white suburban homeowners and business owners who saw, like GM, that the suburbs were the safest places for investment. But once they left the city, they wanted nothing else to do with it, in part because they were adhering to Federal Housing Administration policies that rewarded suburbs for seceding from central cities. And so we have this clash during the post-war period between different visions of metropolitan development. Ultimately, it was the suburban secessionist vision of capitalist growth that triumphed in the Flint metropolitan area. And that had very grave consequences for the city's economic future, and also for its patterns of social inequity. And what I mean by that is that once these plants were built in the suburbs, and once suburbs had incorporated, that effectively shielded them from urban growth. And so those plants were now possessed by those communities. The city of Flint was unable to tax them, unable to obtain economic benefits from them. At the same time, it also meant declining prospects for employment among black workers in the city. And so this moment in the late 1950s, it's in chapter 5 of the book where I document the rise and fall of New Flint and metropolitan capitalism, that is really a turning point in the book, because after that, GM, or the city of Flint, is economically isolated. and really unable to grow its boundaries and support new economic development. And that means ultimately that they have to turn to urban renewal as a way to clear space in the city to build new factories. And when they did that, that ultimately led to the hardening of racial division through public housing for the residents of neighborhoods that they cleared. And so there was really a cascade of effects that happened as a result of this failed New Flint plan of 1958.
And I feel like we still see that dynamic in Michigan between that sort of what you call the suburban capitalists and the cities. I mean, we saw that, I think, with Detroit and with Flint continuing today in many respects.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where Flint is representative of what's happened in a lot of other places. What I try to highlight in the book is that during the 1950s, there were other options available. I don't want to push that point too far. Both proponents of metropolitan capitalism and suburban capitalism believed in the necessity of segregation, for example, but there were other options available that would have presented Flint with a starkly different economic future. But as you said, ultimately it was the politics of suburban secession, of suburban capitalism that won out in the end.
I want to wrap this up with sort of a very broad question centered around your title, Demolition Means Progress. I mean, to a certain extent, mm-hmm. is so much of this, and I guess part of it is in Flint in particular. I think it was I-475, which was basically cut through the city, or at least a big African American neighborhood, and sort of destroyed that community and put people in
right.
public housing and just really destroyed the fabric of that community in many respects. Which is not to say that necessarily it was in great shape, but there were other things that you could have done with it, I guess, to improve mm-hmm. it. But this idea of demolition means progress. I mean, is it really a quality to this that it's like any activity that we can generate as capitalists, as people who have the ability to build something and develop it. I mean, because I'm thinking, right now we're sitting a couple of blocks away from a development. I guess it's now, I don't know, 10 years old now, maybe less, the old mm-hmm. Atlantic Yards in Brooklyn. And a huge neighborhood was destroyed to make way for Barclay Center and supposedly low-cost housing, which has yet to materialize. But the idea being that, I'm a guy who makes money off a building. So if I can destroy something, it does mean progress. It means progress for me, not necessarily what's going on around it. Like, that's the driving impetus, is the more that we build— and even if I have to take it down 10 years later, if I get the contract to build it again, I'm going to be making cash. I mean, is that a dynamic that sort of wraps it up? Is that if we can get some type of activity that is profitable for us, that is how we define renewal and progress?
Yes, absolutely. You said it probably better than I could have. This is the... it's in a way, it's kind of embedded in the whole notion of planned obsolescence, which was one of GM's innovations in the automotive industry, that they had to constantly update not only just their car models, but also update the production process to maintain profitability, to increase profitability, and that entailed building facilities, rebuilding those facilities, constantly looking at how to improve the bottom line. And of course, when they did that, in many cases, it required the demolition of old facilities and the reconstruction of new ones. For them, the profits to be had from that process was much more significant than the fate of communities like St. John on the North End. They were committed, again, to expanding the industry, to growing the economy. And for them, the fate of St. John and the North End or other urban neighborhoods outside of the city were really secondary. Their principal aim was to maintain profitability.
Andrew Highsmith, the book is Demolition Means Progress, Flint, Michigan, and the Fate of the American Metropolis. Thank you so much for your time today. We will link to your book at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the chance to speak with you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Now we move into the fun half of the program. Programming note, tonight is Wednesday, October 28th at 8 p.m. It is the cage match. Who are the 10 people that we have on the dais? I don't remember. Who knows? Donald Trump. We don't hear you. I don't hear you, Michael. New Matt has decided to sabotage your microphone. I still don't hear him. Is he plugged in? New Matt has completely sabotaged what you're doing, Michael. And therefore, I know who gets a bonus. We got Donald Trump. We got Ben Carson. We got Marco Rubio. Or the crying caucus, I should say. Rubio, Rand Paul, Jeb Bush. Let's see. And then we got Christie, Kasich, Fiorina. We got Huckabee and Cruz. There's the 10, ladies and gentlemen. Wow, I can name them all. Now I'm getting a buzzing noise. All right, there we go. And I think there is a kids' table, but really at this point, do we care? I mean, what is Bobby Jindal going to do? Is Bobby Jindal even going to show up? I mean, I honestly think that, like, I think that Bobby Jindal could disrobe. I think they all could disrobe. Pataki, Graham, Jindal. Is there anybody else? I can't hear you. Sorry. Pataki, Jindal. They could all disrobe, and I don't think anybody would pay attention to what they're saying. I mean, Graham now is just sort of talking. Like, I think Lindsey Graham is, frankly, he's just going on to these television programs. I think he's just drunk. I mean, he just sounds like a guy who's just like, I don't give a shit anymore. I'm partying. Totally partying for this entire thing. It's quite clear to, I think, Graham, that we're not going to be leading a ground invasion, or he's got one now. I guess we're now there's talk of boots on the ground fighting ISIS. He's got what he wants. He's just partying. A couple of poppers and a jug of vodka, and I think he's going off. I don't think he cares anymore. But we will not be doing live coverage of the kids' debate. Now, in the event that any of them disrobe, we will certainly talk about it. But right now, we're planning, I think, at around 7:30 to start our coverage, 7:45 probably. The debate starts at 8. We will do our live coverage. We will, of course, be critiquing it during it because that is what constitutes fair use. We are a political commentary program, ladies and gentlemen. This is a news event. We will be interpreting it in real time. We will probably be putting 3 doll's heads in front of our camera to signify that we are also satirizing it in the way that Mystery Science 3000 did. So I want that firmly established that we believe that this is fair use. If you want to just watch the debate without the added value of our critique, you can go and do that on CNBC, I think it is. But if you want the added value of a critique to understand the implications of what you're watching, what's that noise? You got to be careful about getting near electrical wires and whatnot. Yeah, whatever that is not good. You got to be careful of that right there. I don't know what's going on with that. But you got to stop that. Okay, that's good. So 7:30, 7:45 tonight, we will be live. You can check it out at our YouTube page at youtube.com, Sam Cedar. All right, just move that, unplug that one, put that one down. There we go. And you can check it out then. Folks, let me remind you, too, that we rely on our members to continue this show and to support it. We've been doing okay with ads. I mean, but honestly, it's, you know, I would say now, we used to say 98.8%. I would say now we're at about 95% if these ads maintain at this rate. But one of the benefits of being a member is we do not include the ads. So members are going, what? You've got ads? Because they don't know. They don't hear it. They don't hear the Harry's or the ZipRecruiter or whatever it is. Now, for some, you know, for members, don't, before members start complaining to me, when we get a new ad in that we think will interest you, or you get a freebie or something like that, we tell you. We do it once. And that's it. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. We have expanded our staff, so our margins are thinner. I've been working diligently on our new set, and I'm looking at part of it, and it actually came out pretty well. I'm pretty shocked. Well, maybe I shouldn't put it that way. I'm pleasantly surprised. Shocked is maybe too strong a word. What, you want to weigh in, Kelly?
Yeah, I think it came out really well.
Well, thank you, Kelly. I appreciate that.
You made it yourself, literally, and from scratch. And
I don't know.
You're a man of many talents.
Mm. Well, you know, Kelly's been going off on Kelly's surprise about that is, I think, probably a sort of a veiled ethnic comment, but we don't need to go into it. We'll talk about this in the fun half of the program. Michael told me to say that. I can show you the I am. He told me to say that. Folks, also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon MAJORITY, get 10% off. Get the Majority Report blend. Give it to your friends. Give it to a gift. Kelly, have you gotten your parents a Majority Report a bag of coffee? I know your folks like to drink coffee.
Yes, I have.
Have you really?
No.
Wow. Oh, well, you know, Kelly's willing
to just
completely lie. And
I'm saving up, and yet,
well,
they're going to hear this.
Well, have your parents sent you a bag of Majority Report coffee?
Oh, my gosh. My parents don't. I owe them for the rest of my life. I'm going to send them some coffee.
Why am I hearing an echo now? Now I'm getting an echo. Wow, that's weird. All right. We got to take a quick break. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. 646-257-3920. Folks, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. We will be on tonight at 7:45 or so for the debate. Tomorrow, Cliff will join us to do a recap of the debate. And see you in the fun half.